How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. Well, worked. I was just sitting there waiting and nothing was happening. So
that happens.
So I don't know, but anyway, good.
I'm glad we got it to work.
Yes, exactly. So
so we've never met, so tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, let's see. I live here in Los Angeles. I'm actually in my childhood home.
Oh wow.
I was living in Washington State for 25 years, and a series of things happened with the family, and I ended up coming back to LA to care for my mother. And I'm living in my childhood home now, and she's like, you know, 5 minutes away in an assisted living place. She's 94 now.
Wow.
And yeah. And, you know, it's kind of convoluted, the whole thing, you know, what happened. You know, I had to make some very monumental type of decisions. My father passed away in 2011, and I was the one, you know, we were three brothers. And so I was the child that ended up caring for the parents. You know, you hear that it seems to go to one. And so I started out doing this long distance. And it's, you know, extremely challenging to do that. But, you know, I was trying to maintain my life. I was living with my girlfriend and her two daughters. And my dad passed away in 2011. And then my older brother started having issues. And then he passed away in 2014.
Oh, my.
And so my mom was down here. My brother, Rick, the one that passed away, he was 45 minutes away from my mother and father. He was the one that stayed down here.
Yeah, he was the one that was going to care for them.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And so anyway, willy-nilly, I mean, I ended up disassembling my life in Washington and coming down here to care for my mom. It's kind of amazing because it's been, in some ways it's been the best thing for me. I was at a place in my life where it would seem that I would be content. But something just wasn't right. I mean, and I've always been a searcher, and it seems that I would keep on getting to a point where, like, is this it? Is this life? You know, there's something wrong here. And so then, you know, I've made many changes in my life. And so this was another one of these big changes. But, you know, it ended up being such a it's continuing to happen, but I mean, it's just been a whole self study learning process, and I've just come to know myself and understand my family, my heritage, in ways that I was never able to reach, you know, earlier. I could just you know, I was probably kind of floating, you know, and I'm still kind of floating in some ways, you might say, but the things that I've achieved just through finally getting to really a kind of a process, I would say, and sort of a method that works for me. Mm-hmm. To you know, to start really understanding life and what life's all about, and you know, what it is to be a human being and stuff like that. So
Keep going.
Yeah, you just have to kind of thank the Lord, or, you know. I was just going to say thank Jesus. thank Hashem, you know. See, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know where to start, really. I mean, I've always been interested in philosophy and religion and just trying to understand how things work. Here I'm listening to myself talking, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is like a confession.
Well, I am recording, but I can stop, and we don't have to share it. So if you want to go deep, I'll click the button now.
Well, no, but you know what I was – see, the thing is, I was thinking, I've watched a lot of your videos. You know, I started following you about a year ago. And first I was following Jordan Peterson, and the way I got to Jordan Peterson was because I've been in Jungian analysis for like 5 years. So much reading, and then started to watch videos, you know, and then the way the algorithm works, it starts spitting out all these things, right?
Yeah.
So that's sort of how I came to you know, listen to you. And you might think, well, you know, what's a Jewish guy listening to you for or something? I mean, I just find all this stuff so fascinating. I don't want to be limited by the typical kind of borders and limitations, you know, you know, that we have, society puts upon us, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of, you know, kind of where I'm at and how I'm talking to you today, you know.
Well, you obviously wanted to talk to me. I mean, you can listen all you want, but why'd you want to talk?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that come up in the conversations about Jung and about belief. I wrote some things like, see if I'm looking at my notes here. You know, like one thing that you guys,
all of us in the little boxes on the computer.
What's that?
Oh, which guys? All of us in the little boxes on the computer.
Exactly. you know, this question of belief, like whether Jordan Peterson believes in God or not.
Yeah.
And I found that a really interesting question. And I noticed, have you watched any of the interviews with Jung that are available online?
I've seen some of them a little bit, but I really should look more deeply at them.
Yeah. Well, so there's this one that he did with, I think it's a BBC guy. And so one of the questions the guy asks Jung, I think it's like 8 or 10 minutes in, you know, he asks him whether he believes in God. You know, and God, and Jung, you saw that one. Yeah. Yeah. And so he says something, I don't believe, I know, or yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And then later on in the video, he starts talking about belief and the issues with that word, and how he's a scientist, and he doesn't believe anything willy-nilly. There has to be a reason, you know? And so I like Jordan's answer, you know, because I think about, when you think about belief, well, what is it that you're believing in? And then you have to think about, well, what what exists. Because if you believe in something, well, something, you're believing in a thing, right?
And an object.
An object, exactly, an object. And what are objects, right? You know, and do objects exist? And is God an object? Well, clearly God, if God is some object, is an object, he or she is certainly not like, you know, a glass or a table, right? So then if you start, if you're thinking about existence and you're thinking about belief, then why are we using the same word to talk about these things that are so worlds apart, right?
Yep. Right?
So, but then, you know, you as a pastor, it's an important question for you. And I think that has to do with religion, maybe. And so I wonder about that, you know, in my own understanding of Judaism. And so, you know, like the synagogue that I sometimes go to, we're a Reconstructionist synagogue. I don't know if you've heard of Reconstructionism, but it's an American kind of variety of Judaism. Mordechai Kaplan was a rabbi in like the 20s or 30s, and his background was Orthodox, but I don't know what the history was of how he came to America, but he realized that American Jews didn't have a form of Judaism that was relevant. And so he wanted to have some kind of renewal and reevaluation, and so that's what Reconstructionism is. So, you know, the temple that I'm at, some people don't believe in God at all, they say, look, you don't have to believe in God, or, you know, and it's disturbing. I mean, but see,
that's an interesting reaction.
Yeah. It's disturbing for me because I just feel in my heart that, you know, even though, you know, I would say, yeah, God exists, or I believe in God, and why in the hell, you know, can't Jordan say, yeah, I believe in God, right? I mean, so, but I think we have to be able to encompass all these ways of understanding these things. And so I just have to kind of, I don't know, what do you, like, when you want to, why do you feel that you, that why is it a need, maybe, that Jordan say, yeah, I believe in God? Like,
I don't really feel like I have a need for him to say that. But, so here's the funny thing about this. You read, you know, the Hebrew scriptures, or the, you know, the Greek New Testament, you don't have any of this talk like we do about believing in God. In fact, as Charles Taylor mentions, that kind of stuff only started happening about 500 years ago up until now. Because to say, I believe in God, well, everybody believes in God. I mean, because, and even the phrase believe in God, because here's part of the funny thing in the Greek New Testament, this pistis, it's, you know, it's just as validly translated trust, if we'd say, I trust in God, in our context, that has a totally different meaning than just like you said, I believe I'm holding this book, or yeah, I believe I'm holding this glass.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I believe in this glass.
Right.
Even in English, it's a dumb thing to say.
Yeah.
But what's happened in since the Enlightenment and the dawn of the secular age is that I believe in God now has a peculiar meaning. And so it's a very strange thing. I think it's far more interesting that everyone wants Jordan Peterson to talk about this than even Jordan Peterson's strange, quirky refusal to talk about this, because that's interesting. And then Jordan Peterson puts his own twist in it. Well, I act as if God is real. Well, obviously, if you want to understand Peterson's answer, you have to go down this whole thing of understanding pragmatism and form for object, world conceived as space of object versus form for action. It's just like, so, but at the same time, him not answering the question, it's like someone comes up to you, how are you today? I'm fine. When you say you're fine, it's a way of saying, I want to move on with this conversation beyond well, Peterson decides he's going to stop at this juncture and we're going to talk forever about it. And he's going to be a doggone stubborn Northern Canadian and nobody's going to put words in his mouth. I mean, he'll go to jail. He'll do the hunger strike. let's have fun with this then. Let's play this game. What do you mean by belief? And it's actually, I think, a gift to all of us that doggone stubborn Canadian digs his heels in and says, I'm not going to play that language game. So now all of us can have a very interesting conversation about what do you mean by believe, which is not a simple thing, and what do you mean by God, which is not a simple thing. So Jordan Peterson's stubbornness is a gift to all of us so we can explore these ideas.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think about Jordan and who he's speaking to. And in some ways, I don't feel like I'm his normal audience.
Now, I don't know what his normal audience is.
No, but what I mean by – well, so that's the thing. You know, you get in these kind of really – prejudicial or stereotypical ideas. I mean, first of all, when I started hearing and watching Jordan Peterson, you know, I had already read a lot of Jung and a lot of other philosophers and psychologists. So I was like, good. And I thought, well, this is really neat that he's saying this on YouTube and anybody can watch this. And he's really gifted at just making things kind of clear and simple and, conveying ideas. And so then I start thinking, that he's talking to a set of people that normally aren't in this conversation. And so I just think that's fantastic. You know, now the kind of stuff that I'm interested in, he's sort of like bringing it into the mainstream, because I mean, I feel unmainstream, you know, and I mean, I don't talk about any of this stuff, you know, with my friends. I mean, I have one friend who, is a rabbi. He's not a practicing rabbi, but he went to a rabbinical school. But he's such a difficult person for me to talk with that I don't talk with him that often. My other friends, I mean, I just start kind of trying to talk about things like this and it's just the conversation doesn't go anywhere, you know? I can talk about stuff like this, you know, with my therapist.
If you pay him.
You know, and actually that's the other thing that I guess I kind of wanted to say is little bit talk about Jung, because see, Jung is, well, gosh, what I'm thinking of a lot of different things all at once. See, the way that when Jordan talks about Jung, he's talking about Jung as if Jung is a philosopher in some ways. But if you read Jung, you see that he had a mission as a doctor to help people.
That's really helpful to me. Keep going.
And so if you look at Jung as a philosopher, then you're using the wrong perspective, really, because he never tried to become a philosopher or write as a philosopher does, with proving the axioms and, you know, having a thesis that is you can argue, and you know, that other philosophers will converse with you and say this, but what about that? You know, he borrowed from a lot of philosophers, and he obviously read widely, but I think his mission was to help people and to help himself. And so when Jordan and some other people talk about Jung, but they don't have the experience of, let's say, therapy or, you know, or trying to help themselves in that sort of a setting, then they're talking about Jung in a way that is, it's not really, it's not exactly relevant. It doesn't really fit in with kind of the context of what his writing was and what his mission was. I don't know. I don't know if that's coming across.
You just kind of, when you said he talks about him as a philosopher, he just kind of opened a window for me, because here's some interesting tidbits about Peterson from what we know, or at least what's been presented. Number one, he's read a lot of Jung. Jung's one of the favorite people, one of his favorite philosophers. Peterson did not work as a Jungian analyst. I mean,
right.
He worked as a clinical psychologist, but he seemed to do mostly cognitive behavioral therapy.
Exactly, yeah.
And Jung was someone that he's read for his philosophy. And also Peterson has said, you know, he's never been in therapy himself, sounded like of any kind. And when I was wondering about that. Because in my particular meetup here in Sacramento, we have a number of people a couple of people with PhDs in psychology, some of whom are active practicing therapists. And when I heard Peterson say that, I thought, what? Because generally speaking, I know a fair number of people that have gone into becoming therapists. Doing therapy is like one of the big elements of how you become a therapist.
Right.
Just like going to church is part of how you become a pastor, even though you go to school too. You know,
right.
A pastor who never goes to church, most denominations are going to say, well, why don't you first go to church before we think about you being a pastor? And so here you have with Peterson, he's not a Jungian therapist.
Right, right.
But he's read it. And so when you said that sentence, it's like, bang, that's exactly right. He reads Jung as a philosopher.
Right.
He doesn't read Jung as a doctor.
Right,
so
right.
That was really helpful for me.
Right. I mean, yeah, and I'm glad that you said that about, you know, I was wondering about that, if he had done any therapy or, you know, I think it was actually Jung, not Freud, that came up with the idea that any therapist who's, you know, worth his, you know, whatever, should have gone through his own process. But the thing is that, you know, with any kind of person who generates something new, like Jung, you say, well, who did Jung go to therapy with, right?
Right.
Or who did Freud go to therapy with? You know, so, I mean, I think that Peterson is very intelligent, and he says, and I'm impressed by a lot of his interpretations. I think that Jungians probably kind of want to sort of stay away. One thing is that Jungians are practicing professionals, and I wouldn't think that they really want to kind of get into the back and forth unless, because it's public and you got to think about your clients and, you know, what's my therapist doing on YouTube, you know, right?
And he's talking about this person. Is he talking about me? He is talking about
right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The confidentiality.
But you know, your point is incredibly important, because it's funny, because Peterson, as a, you know, people have characterized him as an advice giving uncle. And quite frankly, in some ways, he's a moralist, and also, and this sounds really weird coming from a Calvinist, he's kind of a Puritan. You know, he's giving bright moral lines,
right?
You know, exercise willpower, you know, right. Discipline your life, move ahead. That's a very different approach from, you know, sitting with your therapist once a week and talking.
Right.
So Peterson is not. No, I think your comments and your points are dead on right.
Well, there's something really kind of straight laced about him, you know, and a little bit narrow, but that's fine. I mean, that's the thing. That's another thing that I start to see, you know, with all this, is that it's so hard to see another person and to sort of accept that another person has a completely different way of putting life and sense together. Everybody is always like so oriented to their own vision of what makes sense. And so if you were to explain something that doesn't work for me, you know, and I'm just like, don't put that in my brain, right? You know, and like, you're wrong, because you have to be wrong, because I can't be right. You're right. So it's like, I've still never met a person or a wise man who really respects another person's point of view, like utterly respects another person's point of view. I mean, you have to get away from any kind of violent, evil, you know, harmful kind of a person. But I mean, you listen to any, you know, intelligent person, they're always kind of dissing the other side. And, you know, and I think that that's just part of our nature, that we have such a hard time understanding how other people put it together. You know, so anyway, I'm kind of looking at the time, because I mean, I've talked about some of the stuff I wanted to talk about, but there's some other stuff, and I really do. When do you have to go?
Well, you're my last call of the day, so I've got some flexibility. So
Going. Oh, well, that's cool. Cool. Because I had a really interesting experience. I guess I'd call it an experience where I started thinking about Adam and Eve and Jesus. And it was just, it was really fascinating. So I want to make sure I talk about that. Let's see. Here's a question I guess I would say is, and in a way, this really isn't so much about Peterson, but about Jung, that is there a hesitation, let's say, for you as a Christian to take what Jung has to say, in a certain, do you have to keep him at arm's length? Because I think Jung he's like a Gnostic type of a, if he's a Christian, he's a Gnostic type of, I don't know if that means you're a Christian if you're Gnostic, where like God encompasses both the good and evil. I think, isn't that what the Gnostic vision of God is? No?
There's lots of, almost if you say the Gnosticism was an incredibly broad movement. Even talking about Gnosticism in the second through sixth centuries in the Eastern Roman Empire, it's incredibly, it was more of a, it was almost more of a fashion, a philosophical fashion that permeated lots of different beliefs, Judaism, Christianity, so on and so forth. And Gnosticism was a movement that Christianity almost didn't survive, partly because you could read some Christian books, especially the Gospel of John, through a Gnostic lens that gave you very different outcomes than, let's say, reading it through the lens of the Hebrew Scriptures. And so one of the things that happened in the early first centuries of Christianity is that they had to do a lot of figuring out in the Greek-speaking world whether Plato or Neoplatonism or Gnosticism was the best backdrop for, let's say, something like the Gospel of John, or was it Genesis through Malachi should be the backdrop for the Gospel of John? And so there's lots of stuff back there. So Gnosticism in and of itself is a tremendously complicated conversation with respect to Christianity. And we're not even talking about Jung and alchemy, and we haven't even gotten there yet. Jung and Christianity, there has been in Western Christianity a very low resolution bias against Jung in Western Christianity for a host of reasons. And in fact, I just picked up a book that I haven't read yet. It's sitting on my shelf at home, Jung and Christianity, which I hope to read. I've got a couple of books here in my office, and once I mention them, I know a bunch of people who watch my channel who always want to talk to me about Jung. Richard Knoll was a person that caused a lot of controversy.
And
Jordan Peterson basically said something about Richard Knoll, didn't say burn his books, but it was close to it. So there's a huge amount of conversation and between Jung and Christianity. So he's the son of a Reformed minister, and a Swiss Reformed pastor. And so there's deep connections between Jung and Christianity. Jung also lived a life which was far less puritanical than Jordan Peterson. And that much is known. And Jung went, you know, so I've read some Jung.
Well, because he had a mistress. Is that?
Yeah. And he also, certain boundaries that have certain boundaries since Augustine that have framed Western Christianity, Jung didn't observe with respect to the spiritual realm. And so there is so much stuff there that many Christians just look over at Jung and it's like, I can't bother with it. I got way too much else to do in my life than deal with the layers and levels and complexity of this man's relationship with Christianity. Other people aren't spooked by him. And now I'm very high in openness. And so my posture tends to be, I'll withhold judgment. I don't stand as Jung's judge.
Yeah.
And then some people listen to me and say, well, you know, all this Jungian stuff that's getting slipped into you via Jordan Peterson. Well, probably. And at some point, I'm going to have to tease it out. But I have a fairly good idea where Christian boundaries are.
Yeah.
I'm not Jung's judge. I would like to learn more of him. I think some of the really interesting insights that Peterson gets, he gets via Jung. But as you said, kind of Jung's philosophy. So there's a whole group of people who are really excited for me to take a deep dive into Jung.
Yeah.
And I've tried reading some of him. The dude is hard to read. Some of his books, I'm just reading dream after dream after dream. And it's like, oh, guy, if I read another one of your dreams, I don't know if I can take it. There's more interesting things for me to read than your dreams. So
right.
I will. Jung is definitely on my list in terms of someone.
But I was wondering, you know, because, I mean, I guess that was my idea Jung does talk about a conception of God. I don't know where he does this, but he does talk about whether evil is part of God or whether evil is separate from God. And so anyway, I guess I was just wondering if that was, but obviously there's a lot of reasons.
Those are hard questions.
Yeah.
And now a very low resolution Christian view, Orthodox view will say God and evil are two different things. Then you read things like the Old Testament, like the book of Jonah and something like the King James Version. And you read, and God repented of the evil he was about to do to Nineveh. And you understand that there's complexities in this word evil and you understand that part of the difficulty with, say, the word evil has to do with the way philosophically, since the 18th and 19th century positivism, we began to handle words with respect to our theology. So that gets really complex. The complexity of the relationship between Jung and Christianity is enormous. And there are people who have spent their whole life working on that. And I'm 55 years old. And I've only got so much life to live, so I'm not going to major in it, probably.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple guys, you know, you probably heard of Edinger and Robert Johnson, who just passed away.
Yeah, someone often talks about him, someone who writes me quite a bit.
Well, there's a movie, I don't know if you get a handle, a hold of this it's really an interview, but it's called Slender Threads. And there's a pastor who interviews him. And they talk for a couple hours about all sorts of things. And so you can kind of see how these things are, maybe that's be a guy for you that he also writes, like he writes these little skinny books. And he was one of these people that could just write really simple sentences and take somehow talk about complex ideas in this really kind of just kind of sitting by the fire sort of a way. So I think he's amazing.
Okay.
But the other thing is, I just would mention this book. This was like Psychological Types. Hmm. If you read like the, you might be able to, I don't know about the first, but he's basically talking, well, this is just fascinating. I find this book just completely amazing. But he talks about Tertullian and Origen.
Mm-hmm. Church fathers.
And he's contrasting them. So, you know, you wouldn't have to read the whole thing, but I would think just because of the subject matter, you might kind of like it, at least to get. See, the thing is, he's so long-winded. I mean, he's a little bit like Jordan Peterson is, where Jordan Peterson just kind of goes off, right? And you're not really sure where he's going. And then finally he winds up, you know, he's not like Sam Harris, like, you know, or like Steven Pinker, like, okay, everything has to be totally, you know, literal or linear, you know. So, yeah.
So that book that you're looking at, so I'm looking on Amazon right now.
Oh, Psychological Types.
During conversations. Psychological Types by Jung. It's a collected work of Jung, volume 6. I don't know if I'm just trying to see. Because I, you know, here's, oh boy, I get it. See, here's another little sociological fact.
Yeah.
When I, as a pastor, talk about Jung, I get it from both sides. I've, you know, obviously got the Christian tribe on one hand saying, turn away, you know, don't waste your time. And the Jungian side saying, oh, you got to read him because you can't talk about Jordan Peterson without reading him. And when I was reading the, you know, Jung's autobiography, I'll tell you, when you're reading him and having listened to a ton of Peterson, it's like, oh boy, I hear, you know, when I'm reading Jung,
yeah,
I see where Peterson gets a bunch of his stuff. It's all over him. So
yeah.
It's really helpful for me. The more Jung I know, the better I can understand Peterson just in terms of, you know, figuring out where these ideas come from, where they go, how they work, so on and so forth. But what you said to me, the sentence, which was, you know, Peterson reads his philosophy. And I thought when you said that, it was just like lights came on because I thought, oh, that's really helpful in terms of looking at it. Yeah, I see Psychology in the Classical Era, Gnostics, Tertullian, Origen. Theological dispute. Yeah, I'll take a look. Problem of transubstantiation. See, there's so, you know, to understand history and the world.
Yeah,
there's so much.
Oh my gosh.
You know, we live these tiny little lives, and the amount of attention that we can actually pay to this entire world out there. I mean.
Right. There's so many books, you can't possibly read them all. And and the interesting thing about this is that you look at this and you go, oh, I'm going to learn about, you know, the classical age, or I'm going to learn about, you know, theological disputes. But the thing is, the reason why he's writing this is because he wants to contrast introverted thought processes with extroverted thought processes. That's why. So this book goes into, in the succeeding chapters, he picks a different medium like poetry or philosophy or, you know, some other, and he'll take like usually two, he jumps around a little bit, but he takes like two different versions and he goes, you see how there is a formulation of philosophy like this. And then here's a formulation of philosophy that is in some ways opposite. And so, see, the reason why he wrote this book was because he was with Freud, you know, and Freud was sort of like his mentor. And then he started kind of breaking from Freud, and he started wondering, well, how is it that, and there was also Adler. And so these three guys, and so Jung is thinking, well, how is it that Freud is so sure that he's right, and he has this beautiful, you know, framework, and then Adler has another framework, and he's right, and then I'm like, well, what about me? And so then he started realizing that there were different forms of consciousness. And the way consciousness is such a kind of a baggagey word.
Yes.
But let's say that it's how you make sense of the world, right? And so he started thinking, okay, Freud has a way of making sense of things in his particular way. And so his methodology, his whole philosophy is sort of a, like an artifact of his whole voyage to get to know, to understand things. And then Adler, same thing, but came up with a different formulation. And then Jung comes up with another formulation. How is it that there can be these three formulations? And then, you know, if there's just one consciousness or something like that, or, you know, so, so anyway, that was sort of how he started thinking about that, that there's different forms of making sense of the world. And so that's why he wrote this. And then he's like, okay, Tertullian, he was probably, you know, a certain sort of, had a certain sort of psychological mindset and came up with his version of truth. And Origen was somebody else and came up with his version. And then, you know, is one right and the other wrong? No. I mean, somehow they're both have, you know, they have truth and they have rightness and, so anyway, that was sort of,
And talking about, you know, right and wrong, you know, did Origen get everything right? Did Tertullian get everything right? Can I get everything right? I mean, that's, we need those verbal tools to suss out things. But so, you know, so we've got this consciousness. I mean, even what you and I are doing right here, you and I, we both have these heads and we've got all these things going on in our heads, only tiny, which we're conscious of.
Right.
And then we've got stuff in our consciousness, which is actually fatter than what either of us can articulate through our mouths at each other. And everything that we're hearing from the others passes through our filters.
Right,
and
right.
We have, you know, both of us have multiple decades of filters built up to.
How do we understand anything, right?
Exactly. That's a good question. And then we're going to sit here and, okay, we're going to talk about God. and the fact that it's just a three-letter word tells us something that, you know, some of the most foundational things, ma, da, cat, dog, God, you know, it's these,
I like that, yeah.
It's these short words that have the biggest, you know, freight with us.
Right.
And then, you know, when you talk about language, you know, lately I've been reading or trying to read or at least reading about Lewis's friend Owen Barfield, and I just put him in a video that I just did recently.
Wait, Lou?
Owen Barfield.
And what did you say, Lewis?
C.S. Lewis.
Oh, C.S. Lewis. Oh, okay.
C.S. Lewis, this Oxford Don.
Yeah, I haven't really read a lot, but of course, yeah. I know so, you talk about C.S. Lewis a lot, right?
Lewis, huge guy in terms of, which is kind of crazy in terms of Christianity, serious Christian, but, you know, he probably wouldn't be allowed to be a member of an evangelical church just because of bunch of his beliefs. But anyway, so his friend Owen Barfield, who was, and this is one of the areas I want to explore a little bit too myself, Owen Barfield did a lot of thinking about how language is, in a sense, the artifacts of different experiences of consciousness through the ages. So this thing that all of us have that we are not in control of, which is consciousness, which we have so little understanding of, we don't know really where it comes from, how it develops. We don't even know what has it. I mean, does my cell phone have consciousness?
It's funny that you bring that up because I've been reading, I've been actually writing a paper on Marie Kondo's book.
Oh, okay.
And so she talks about that she was a Shinto shrine maiden for like 5 years. And she starts talking about in the book, I don't know if you read the whole book. I know you've mentioned it a few times.
My wife did her closet, and my closet looked horrible and her closet looked nice. So it's like, I'm down. I'm going to do my closet.
Well, it's a real, I think it's an amazing book, actually. I'm
really,
I'm kind of blown away by it. But there's the whole very kind of primitive animist, naive element to it. Where,
this is her book, Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up?
Yeah, yeah. Where she talks about talking to the house. She talks about talking to her possessions. And so, you know, as if the house has a spirit, the house has some kind of subjective aspect to it. And you know, everything, like, you know, this book, you know, I'm supposed to hold this book and I'm supposed to decide if I want this book and what it, and so she kind of also questions, well, what does the book want? You know, does the book want me to keep, or does, and then when you decide to discard, some item that you've decided that you no longer want, you know, instead of just taking it and going, I'm so glad to be rid of this, or why did I ever keep it for so long? You're like, thank you so much for being a part of my life, you know, and I'm going to send you off, but the thing is, there's something about it, you know. So, yeah, exactly. I don't know. I mean, because that kind of goes to the whole as if thing, because, I mean, if you behave as if everything has a spirit, if I behave as this book has, you know, some kind of subjectivity to it, what kind of, does that help me? You know, so then you have these useful fictions, right? So, yeah.
Well, and I spend some of my time with people who are obsessive compulsive and have some hoarding tendencies. And so then you look at someone who you take to a restaurant and he picks up a napkin and it's like, you're not bringing that home. No, I have to. And then mm-hmm. he goes to the bathroom and he comes out. And then, of course, I'm just such a jerk. I'm a bad pastor. I really am. And I say, so you're going to leave what you left in there, but you're going to take the napkin home. And
uh-oh, wow.
I
like it.
But it doesn't help that person at all, but it helps me deal with their issues because I can at least.
Well, it might have just gone in your head, so.
But no, these are, you know, and these are really fascinating. So this, you know, I've been thinking about consciousness a lot lately. This idea that, you know, and so part of what Owen Barfield talks about is how, if you read poetry going back, you very much get the idea that if, you know, someone who lived 2,000 years ago in Alexandria in Egypt, stands to reason the world they're living in, their assumptions are very different from my assumptions. And we all can all understand that. My whole life, I grew up a white kid in a transitioning neighborhood, a black neighborhood. At church, most of the folks around us were black, some white. During the week, I'd go to Dutch Calvinist day school. And so all of my life, I've lived in the middle of lots of different cultures. And one of the things that you learn is that people see the world differently. And we hear that and we think, oh yeah, I accept that. But to actually, and then you marry someone and you begin recognizing, and you're around this person a whole lot and you're there for the same event and you realize, boy, we sure saw that event in two different ways.
Oh, yeah.
And, on and on and on. And so you begin to realize, all of these simplistic ways of seeing the world, that's just dumb. Most of us should have access to it. And then you realize, again, I use this, one of my favorite little things from Peterson is when he was talking to Roger Scruton, and Peterson says, we probably see the world mostly as a set of memories that whatever the outside world is there that are triggering in us, and we filter them all through these memories, and you begin to realize, this thing that we're doing, walking around, talking to each other, buying stuff, it's insane. And Peterson is dead on right. It's amazing things work as well as they do. Right, the whole thing is, speaking as a Christian, it's a gift from God. Because if you think about how enormously complex this thing is. So a few years ago, I had a couple of Rottweilers. They died. And my daughter, who loves animals, can we get another dog? Maybe. Once I said maybe, boom, dog. And then I'd really love a cat. It's like, we got dog. No cat, dog. But there's a stray cat, stray kitten, tiny little kitten. And it's like, am I going to turn the kitten away? No. So now I have dog and cat.
Oh, yeah.
And they're both about the same size. And I watch these two creatures try to find each other. And I just sit there and I think, boy, yeah. It's amazing we human beings do anything. And that we're still getting along in this world and we haven't destroyed each other.
Right.
And Peterson articulates that so well and poignantly. And, I think what Peterson has done, whatever the content that he has delivered to us, which I've really appreciated, the real gift he's given us is just that he somehow created a space, which is the best word we can which is kind of analogous to consciousness, created a space in which people can kind of come into the room and have enjoyable conversations with each other where we feel we're learning something and getting good things out of it. That's a huge gift.
I mean, I saw there was, I don't know if it was official, but I started watching the debate with Slavoj Žižek.
Yeah, I'm going to post, when I get home, I'm going to post my commentary on it. I don't use any clips from it, but I got about an hour and some of talking about it. So keep going.
Oh, great. Well, there's two guys who you would think are going to be like oil and water, and they're just, and even before the debate, I listened. Peterson said, well, I'm going to really have to hold myself back because I'm going to just get so angry and frustrated. And I started watching this, and it was just like, this is really beautiful. I didn't watch the whole thing, but it's like, they were communicating and kind of communing together. And I was really happy that Slavoj was reading something. Because he wasn't just being extemporaneous, because that would have been just crazy, you know, because I but, you know, it's like, yes, I agree with you, Jordan. He's like, yeah, I agree with you. It's like, what? So, I don't know. I didn't watch the whole thing yet, but I'm really interested to see what you say about it. And,
well, it's supposed to be this big fight, and it wound up being a sloppy, wet kiss, you know?
Exactly. So maybe they'll do it again. Like
conversation is so much fun.
Like the same thing with Sam Harris, right? It's like it started out really rough, but then, you know, they're all nicey-nice and like, oh, yes, Jordan and blah. So, yeah, it's funny.
Well, I think they're gonna continue to be more friction between Peterson and Harris than Peterson and Zizek.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. Peterson, well, and when my commentary on it, you know, what's interesting about Zizek is that on one level, he's so much fun and he's so clever and he's so bright and he offers so much good stuff. On another level, and I only know him via this conversation,
yeah,
he's an extremely pessimistic nihilist. You know, we're all screwed. So yeah, at least let's have fun conversations before we, you know, slide off into the great abyss.
But no, it's interesting that you say that, because I recall Peterson saying how really, I don't know if he used the words pessimistic, but you know, he's very aware of all the negative that humans can do to each other. And I think that his optimism is born out of just a realization that you need to be optimistic in order to keep going. Because, yeah, you know,
because he's got nothing else. He doesn't. I mean, and that's when you get to the end of my video, that's, so here you have a merry nihilist pessimist, and what I think Peterson finally is a hopeful humanist. Yeah. And so I kind of dissect, I don't play any clips from it because it's only the pirated version that's out there right now.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it was a fascinating conversation. It was delightful to watch. It was fun. But it's interesting if you stop and you think about the worldviews, especially Zizek's, to the degree that I could discern it from the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we are, it's complete atheism. It's, we, you know, the whole thing is just a comedy of fury and chaos. That's what life is. And so, you know, he's probably the most thoroughly postmodern person I've ever heard. Seriously. Incredible. Because most people who are sort of postmodern, they don't really pull it off. They've got too much of a narrative that's actually functioning. Zizek, no, he calls himself a Hegelian. I don't think he's even that. I think he's so thoroughly postmodern, it's hard to label him as anything. At least that was my read on him from the conversation.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, I've watched some other things that it seemed like he, where I really kind of questioned, well, what does this guy believe? And no, but not that he doesn't believe anything, but that he does have a way to formulate his ideas. I mean, he cares about the human race, and he cares, right? So, a nihilist, you would think, well, they don't care about anybody or anything. So I would kind of hit. I don't know about the nihilistic part, because, you know, I mean, and how could, like, Peterson and him, how could they have a wet kiss? I mean, if,
well, I don't know. Well, I think that maybe there are dark nihilists and light nihilists, and Zizek would be a light one, because he'd be like, yeah, there's nothing, there's no hope. And, you know, there's no hope. So, you know, what are you gonna do? But so in the meantime, point out all the absurdities and wrong things that you see and enjoy each other.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was my read. And, you know, there's plenty of people out there who've read his books and have listened to him more, and I'm happy to be pointed out wrong, but based on that was kind of my take on him. So maybe I'm wrong. We'll see.
So, I don't know what your time's like, but, I realized there's something that I wanted to talk about. How are you doing on time?
Another 10 minutes or so, then we should probably wrap up.
Okay. So, in some ways I'm interested in what you think of this kind of reading, but, see if I can sort of replicate it. So, you know, I was thinking about how I bear so much, there's so much baggage, and I bear so much in terms of responsibility for my actions. And, you know, it's hard to do that on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, I realized that it was bothering me, it was disturbing me, and, you know, it's something, I guess it was something that I felt like I was articulating that really I hadn't articulated so well before. And so I started thinking about the Garden of Eden, and so I thought about see if I can do this. So I guess I'll just try to drive right through and see if it works. So when they end up eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that is usually considered to be evidence of their failure, of the fact that they have something inside that tends them towards being seduced and to do what they're not supposed to do. But I had this other thought that it was actually eating of the fruit of good and evil that gave Adam and Eve the insight to see that they sometimes screw up. You know, so that original sin is, you might say that it's a sense of inferiority or of inadequacy, you know, that you, before they had eaten of the fruit, they couldn't see that everything they attempted to achieve, they didn't achieve. Everything they tried to do, they did, or they didn't have the concept that that there was a possibility of imperfection and perfection. And so eating of the fruit of good and evil, in a way, that was a way of saying, now I can differentiate. Now I can notice when I've hit the mark, and when I haven't hit the mark. And because I don't know about belief in God here, but you might say, and I'm to blame for it. It's me, it's in my nature. And so I have to bear this failing, this and this constant sense of inadequacy. So then I thought, but what if there was somebody or something that could bear that baggage, right? So
who could do it for you because you can't do it yourself?
You can't do it because you are imperfect, and so you can't perfectly bear your baggage because you're imperfect, right?
Yep.
But then you pose the idea of, you know, this weight bearer, right?
That's right.
So,
and that weight bearer must be human because otherwise it couldn't qualify for you, but also must be divine because a mere human being couldn't lift it. You're basically articulating the atonement theory articulated in the Heidelberg Catechism.
Well, so, but then listen, where I went with this is that I said, okay, so the weight bearer, now this, you posit, let's say I'm positing a weight bearer.
Yep.
The weight bearer bears my sins, and then he dies. And my sins are born, they're carried. But then he dies, and he's reborn. And so what I'm seeing is that sinfulness, is kind of transformed to a sense that we're all raw and unfinished, and that there's got to be a new way of living where you're not weighted down by a sense of sin or inadequacy or inferiority. And so then I'm translating those sort of moral failings to, wait a minute, why can't we say that human beings are a type of a thing that is like a project in process? They're unfinished, raw, and that's basically how we are, and we never achieve 100%. So, you know, and you're thinking, well, why is a Jew thinking about this? And right? Well, I mean, it various reasons. I mean, it's fascinating, and I feel like I have to be free to consider, you know, how other people think, and I want to also take on anything that will help me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was just there's something about that seemed really beautiful, you know, that there is sort of this two-stage process, you know, of, well, here you are, and you need a Christ or a Jesus to bear you. But then once that's done, then it's sort of like everything's washed away. And then you're in another stage, and you're just clean and pure, and then you can have joy that's not where you don't have to be thinking about, you know, that it's joy dependent upon all this crap that happened. So I don't know. What do you think about that? I mean, it's cool. It's neat. I mean, I like it.
Other Jews have thought it too.
But you see with
Paul
that,
of Tarsus did a lot of thinking about this kind of thing.
Who?
Paul of Tarsus.
I thought I heard Martin Buber maybe was talking about something.
Paul of Tarsus lived a lot longer ago. He was Saul, and he held the cloaks for the stoning of Stephen. Then Jesus shows up on the road to Damascus for him. And then he spends 14 years kind of undocumented. And then he starts writing a bunch of letters, and that's the New Testament.
Oh, that's all.
Yeah. No, what you're thinking is along the lines of the Christian story of atonement in, well, see what happens is that, so Jesus dies and his disciples say, well, we saw him again and we touched him and he wasn't a ghost and he was real. And then he ascended. And then this crazy thing happens at Pentecost and we get changed. But what on earth does all this mean? And so a lot of the New Testament is trying to figure this out. And one of the lines of, so in Christianity, there's all these atonement theories because there seem to be rough sketches of atonement in the New Testament. And one of them is very similar to what you just described, which is a penal substitutionary atonement, which is that sin is a weight. One of the interesting things about the Old Testament is that sin sometimes is a weight that can be borne by an animal, such as the scapegoat, and driven out into the wilderness and sort of dissipates.
Right, right.
Sin is a stain, or sin is a debt. And so you have all these metaphors for figuring out, well, how can we talk about sin? Well, what is sin? Sin is missing the mark. So, so we've got all this mark missing that we're doing, and Leviticus talks about, so you take the animal up into the temple and the father of the family places his hands on the animal and then slits the animal's throat. Well, what's that about? And then the priests, then they have a big barbecue and the priests and their families eat your animal. What's going on here?
Right.
And then of course, once they have this big fight throughout hundreds of years, whether anybody can do this in their backyard or if it must only be done in the temple in Jerusalem and not at Dan and Beersheba. And then the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed and oh gosh, what do we do now? Well, now we'll just observe the Torah instead of, well, then what's the relationship between observing the Torah and placing our hand on this animal before we slit his throat? So, and all of that has to do with this sin business. And then Jesus, John the Baptist in the Gospel of John, Jesus shows up on the scene. Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. What? He just called a dude a lamb.
Right.
And the dude's going to take away the sin. And how's that going to work? And so, you're barking in the same ball field as what folks have been thinking about. How can, what is then, see then later on when I'm, years before I started doing this stuff, I'd spent a lot of time thinking about, well, what's wrong in the world? And I was reading the Apostle Paul and I noticed that if you read passages like Romans 8 or 1 Corinthians 15, Paul keeps talking about this idea of decay, that in this world, everything decays. Well, where did that start? And you read these strange things about God saying the knowledge of the tree, and it's really important. It's not the tree of the knowledge of evil, and it's not the tree of doing evil. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And that's really interesting. And that opens the door to, Peterson's observations, and actually Zizek following Hegel has some observations about that in that conversation. And all of that seems to be, well, on the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. And you think, he'd take a bite and down he'd go, but no, he doesn't. He lives another 900 some years. What's with that? And the Bible is this really strange book. And what it seems to open up for us is all of this interesting exploration and conversation that seems to actually relate to this world here. And so then you get into decay and what is decay and how does that work? And somehow sin and decay are connected because when Jesus is raised from the dead, he's raised with a new body that doesn't decay. It's like, what? What is that about? And so all of this stuff, and what you just articulated is basically atonement theory. The sin goes on the animal, and some animals are slaughtered and burned up. And when you think about some of my early videos, I talked about what altars are, and you read about this in the book of Leviticus. It's so cool when they inaugurate the tabernacle because they build the altar, and they have everything set up. And then Aaron's sons come with some, well, we know what's missing here. We need a fire. They come with fire and whoosh.
Oh, that's when they get killed, right?
That's right. God smokes them. And it's like, yeah, you don't understand. Well, what is the altar? The altar is the fire of God living in the midst of the people. And so the more you study this stuff and put it together, it actually all holds together and fits. And then it's like, it's endless fun is what it is, which is, I guess, why I'm a preacher, but it all fits together. And then it connects up with sin and debt and burden and propitiation, which is basically becoming clean. And well, what does that do? So then Christians have all these conversations. Okay. So Paul in Romans 6 talks about us being bound with Jesus into the waters of baptism. And it's like, you know, we get drowned to death because that's what baptism is. It's an ordeal. And then we're raised to new life. And, but okay, so Jesus and his spirit in terms of Christianity after Pentecost is with us, but we keep sinning. Even Peter and Paul keep sinning. And then death. I mean, it goes on forever, which is, then we're still trying to think about it. And then the fact that, well, if our participating and benefiting from it is dependent upon us being able to mentally construct it correctly, well, then we're doomed because it's just way too complicated. So then it's the idea that, no, actually, it's something that's been done for us and achieved on our behalf. So then the question becomes, well, how can I benefit from it and participate in it and actually manifest it in the day-to-day decisions of my life? And so that's where, you know, I mentioned the Heidelberg Catechism, misery, deliverance, gratitude. So this is all stuff done for me. And so now I want to manifest gratitude for the gifts that I've been given. That's terribly, terribly poorly articulated, I'm afraid, but you pull the string.
But I mean, you know, the thing about if, like, you as a Christian, you can draw upon all the things that you draw upon.
Yep.
The church and the rituals and you know, maybe like a deep sort of commitment or acceptance, let's say, of Jesus, you know, in your heart or something like that.
Yep.
Now, I, as a Jew, I wouldn't do that. You know, my heritage is so important. And so I don't know. What's interesting is I don't know if, see, some Christians would probably say, well, you know, in order to have this whole story, it has to be that Jesus actually existed and that this really happened and that this is the only way, you know, that you can have, you know. And, you know, I don't really have, I'm not feeling like, oh, I've got to have, I have a longing, you know, for this thing. Like, I don't believe that, like, I think that Buddhists and Jews and animists and Marie Kondo, whoever you want to talk about, I think that it somehow it has to be okay that everybody can have their own pathway to, well, Jung would say, you know, individuation, really, to a process of becoming who you are, who you always, your true self. anyway, it's sort of a it could be another conversation. I mean, it gets really, I see you smiling. I mean,
I know, you know, we could talk all night. Yeah. And this is why when we do meetups at my church, it's like we spear for 4 or 5 hours because 10 people having these conversations and off you go.
I know.
But you know, so these questions, you know, if you wanted to read an interesting book on what you just articulated, so C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, it's very interesting because if you read like Houston Smith and his The World Religions, it's kind of a college textbook on world religions. I mean, he describes Hinduism as, you know, everybody gets what they want. Well, that's an interesting idea. Sounds like a cool idea. You read C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, and it's like the book starts out in a place where everyone can have absolutely anything they want just by thinking of it. And you'd say, wow, that sounds pretty cool. And then you realize that this city, which is populated by beautiful homes, the homes just go out and out and out and out and out and out and out, because you begin to discover that everyone keeps building new homes because they're trying to get away from each other because of what they want. And of course, now you're triggering a whole bunch of Buddhist ideas about wanting and desire and all that. And so then you get to the question of, you know, one of the funny things about the assumption of lots of religions is, well, what do all the religions want? What do all the religions say is a fully actualized human being? And and that's a really interesting question, because you can begin to say, well, this is what one group says, and this is what one person says, and so mm-hmm. then you get to something like the Bible, and actually part of what the Bible says is this is what human beings were made to be. Well, what is that? And you know, there's a whole picture around it. So this is really hard, but this is really good. So yeah. We'll have to talk again.
All right.
Maybe. So where what area of LA do you live in? Because I know Southern California is very large.
Pacific Palisades, which is near Santa Monica. And it's really, if you were to take Sunset Boulevard all the way to the coast, Pacific Palisades is the neighborhood that that's just on the shore where Sunset hits. Like just north of Sunset is Topanga and Malibu. So
next time I do a meetup, if I do a meetup in that area, because I've done meetups in different parts of Southern California, I usually travel down there for church work. And there's different churches around, so then I wind up in different places. So
that would be cool. Yeah, actually, for sure.
It'd be really fun to meet you and to hang out. So
yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
But
yeah, I'm glad I finally connected with you.
Yeah, I'm glad you did too. It was great talking to you.
Hey, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
What are you doing on my Martin Buber book?
Let that beard grow a little longer.
Yeah, exactly. I still don't really get this, but anyway.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
It's a tough book.
Yeah. I've got it over there. It is a tough book. I've got more books on my shelf, and I keep adding to them. And you didn't help.
Hey, I got another book. Can I show you what book I'm reading now?
Sure.
This is my brother recommended this, and he got it for me. You see that?
It's from The Dying. Interesting.
And it's written by a Buddhist teacher who's from Seattle, and it's really well written. It's fantastic. And
by Rodney Smith, is that the
one? Yeah.
Well, and you know, it's been so interesting because I've been doing videos on, you know, Vervaeke's stuff, and of course Vervaeke deals more with Buddhism, you know, from that point of view. And what's interesting is that, again, you've always got You know, what are the Buddhism has become so interesting because, you know, I have friends who are highly secular people who have been engaging in Buddhist practice. And so I ask them, well, you know, what about that? And you know, because you're really an atheist. And they're like, yeah, but this really helps me. So I don't believe any of the, basically they don't use these phrases because they don't have any philosophical awareness. I don't do any of the metaphysics. I just do the practice and that helps me. And it's like, oh, that'd be kind of like, you know, taking a pill and saying, well, I don't know what it does in my body, but it makes me feel better. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, that's like kind of the westernized kind of packaging of something, you know, like yoga or meditation, just to kind of get the goods, you know, and then, but not deal with you know, the real difficult questions, right?
And you can do that with alcohol until something else happens.
Right.
Well, I think you and I could talk all afternoon, but
yeah.
So thank you so much for signing up, and I'll send this to you and you can decide what you want to do with it. And just sign up for another time and we'll keep talking.
Okay. That's great. All right, thanks, Paul.
Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Likewise. Bye-bye.